Hello, I'm Jane Crowe, the editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our deputy editor, Matt Matum.
Hello.
And our online editor, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
This week, we're chatting to Pete Docter about Pixar's latest Soul, plus we'll be reviewing that and sci-fi drama The Midnight Sky, as well as Wonder Woman 1984 and Kevin Costner and Diane Lane's thriller Let Him Go. But before we get to all that, we probably should discuss a couple of films that Disney announced last week, just a smattering. What are we thinking about the data dump from Disney on all the things that they'll be releasing over the next few years?
Well, I can tell you that it was very annoying from an online perspective because it came out of nowhere.
I know.
Suddenly we had about 80 Disney, Star Wars, Marvel movies, series all being announced in one go, and my fingers were very tired after typing it all up very quickly. I should apologize because there were probably mistakes somewhere along the way. But
it doesn't matter because it's just the excitement of it. Just like, get it out there. Oh my God, there is so much Star Wars. There's so much Marvel. Not much room for anything else, but does that do it for you?
The thing is, I love Star Wars and I love Marvel, but it almost felt a bit too much for me. Like I'd be slightly concerned, even if you manage to keep up quality, say, because they've obviously got some talented people on board, like Patty Jenkins, obviously doing the Rogue Squadron movie. But when there's just going to be so many coming at you and so many TV shows on Disney Plus, I just feel like Star Wars is one of those things that if you have it too often, it just loses its excitement. That's kind of, wasn't that the prevailing thought about Solo, that it was just too much Star Wars? You know, we'd just been hit by too many films, like
we got fatigued,
too many years in a row. So we had a little break, then Mandalorian kind of really revitalizes it. And then suddenly we're just hit by like, sort of, they said like 10 series in the next couple of years.
That's a lot.
I'm already daunted at not being able to keep up with it and not being able to watch it all.
But, you know, it is a sort of smack in the face to the Warner Brothers release that sort of was a bit of a, oh, we're doing all this and nobody's happy about it. And Christopher Nolan's pissed off. And then Disney launched this huge raft of stuff where all the filmmakers are on board. And you've got Patty Jenkins actually rollerblading down a runway to promote the films that she's doing.
That was cool.
It was cool. Who doesn't love her doing that? I mean, we'll be talking about Patty later. Do you think this is going to make Disney Plus the streaming giant that it wants to be? Is it going to be competing with the Netflix and the Amazons?
I'd say it's interesting. The creators on board, it's not like mega filmmakers. There are obviously like up and coming talents like Deborah Chow with the Obi-Wan series and stuff like that. But then, you know, you've got multiple more series from Dave Filoni, and you know, Netflix have the big names. They've got Michael Bay making movies for them, you know.
David Fincher.
Yeah, there wasn't someone like that where I was like, wow, I really can't wait for that because of who's behind it. Apart from maybe there was one Star Wars show called Acolyte from the creators of Russian Doll that I'm quite excited for because it sounds very different. But, you know, the other stuff that's more reliant on older Star Wars stuff, I feel like, you know, the reason something like Solo, I really enjoyed Solo, but it didn't work as well for me. It was very much tried and tested Star Wars era. I'm quite excited for something new.
Yeah, something completely different.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I'll still watch it all, obviously, and I've been loving Mandalorian.
That's the thing. But you may say, but you will still be glued to it, won't you?
Yeah, definitely. Even for them to come out with all these new Marvel shows, like I think there are 12 announced.
Yeah.
They haven't even released one yet. Like, we've gone a year without MCU stuff.
But that's the thing. We're going to get three different seasons in the first half of next year. It's just like, after waiting this long and then to get WandaVision, Falcon and Winter Soldier, Loki, like all just like bang, bang, bang. That's going to feel like some
embarrassment of riches, isn't it?
The most exciting thing for me was probably Pixar's announcements. After watching Soul, which we'll get onto later. I mean, spoilers, love that movie. So it was made me excited for more new Pixar stuff. And they've announced, you know, new shows, new movies, original stuff. It'll be really cool.
Well, speaking of stuff being in production, we obviously have also breaking news. Tom Cruise isn't happy with his team. Do you think he's got a point, the Cruiser? He's had a shout at his crew saying that they need to be more compliant with COVID restrictions in order for films to get made, because the industry is relying on films actually getting out there and being completed and not being shut down. Do you think he has a point?
Fair play to him, I say. Like, obviously, anyone, you know, we're all trying to get back to work as best we can, you know, and obviously there are some huge films that are doing it under big COVID restrictions. So if you are doing something like that, come on, you've got to take it seriously.
And he does have a point, you know, like we need films to be being made right now in order for them to be available at some point in the future. And if we have a huge gap again, not because we all can't get to the cinema, because there's no product there for us, that's going to be problematic. So, you know, the Cruiser is taking this on his shoulders. He's the savior of cinema. But he might have a point, mightn't he? The way that they've been shooting Mission is the way that other companies have been following suit. And so it can't be seen to be failing. It has to be a COVID secure situation. So yeah, we say bring on the crews. And also, as we were discussing this morning on our WhatsApp group, we're going to employ that shouting technique, aren't we, in Tesco's, on public transport, down the phone with people. People's lives rely on this. Don't mess it up. Shall we move on then to those that have got films out this week? And shall we start with a little bit of jazz with this?
Heaven?
No, it's the great before.
This is where new souls get their personalities, quirks, and interests before they go to Earth.
Meet 22.
I don't want to go to Earth.
Stop fighting this.
I don't want to.
Okay, look, I already know everything about Earth, and I don't want anything to do with it.
You're missing out on the joys of life, like pizza. I can't smell. We can't taste either.
All that stuff is in your body.
No smell, no taste.
Or touch. See?
Okay, I get it.
Okay, so this is Soul, which is Pixar's latest tearjerker following a frustrated jazz musician played by Jamie Foxx, who dies and ends up on the travelator to the great hereafter. But he's not ready to leave Earth just yet. So along with an unborn soul, voiced by Tina Fey, he struggles to get back into his body and his life, teaching her a little about joy de vivre on the way. So, Matt, you sat down with Pete Doctor this week, the Pixar big cheese, to discuss this film. What did you have a little chat about?
Well, we talked about everything, really, like where the idea came from, where the kind of great before of this idea was. Talked about casting, working with his co-director, Kent Powers. Just, yeah, everything, really.
Let's have a listen.
I promise I'll bring us to one.
Spend your precious hours doing what will bring out the real you.
Love.
The brilliant, passionate you.
Love, love.
That's ready to contribute something meaningful into this world.
Love, love. God,
get ready.
Love.
Your life is about to start.
So that was a clip from Soul, and I'm delighted to welcome the film's director, Pete Doctor, to Inside Total Film. Pete, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And congratulations on a wonderful film as well.
Thank you.
First of all, we were hoping today to be joined by co-director Kent Powers as well, who's unable to make it. So could you say a little bit about what he brought to the film in that role?
Yeah, Kemp's now, I think, working on like 15 things at once, the poor guy. One of the reasons we brought him on was because he had written this beautiful play called One Night in Miami, which has now been made into a feature film, which he adapted as well. He was originally brought in because it started as a very personal story for me, and it sort of developed, and one decision after another, which I can go through if you're interested, brought us to the idea of Joe being a jazz musician, which one of our cultural consultants said, well, jazz could more accurately be called Black improvisational music. And we thought, well, okay, if that's the case, which obviously African-American culture brought this amazing art form to the world, it feels like the character should be Black. And I don't really, I'm not in a position to speak with any authenticity. And the character is going to feel flat unless we have someone who can really represent that. So we brought Kemp in initially to help us flesh out the character of Joe and broaden the script. But he ended up just contributing so much to, say, what posters does Joe have up in his backdrop? How does Joe's costume, what would he wear? He just, at every turn, Kemp kept adding to the conversation and the depth of the film and so on. And so we said, well, he needs to be co-director. That's how things went down. And we're really grateful to all that he brought to the movie.
How did it start out? How did the idea sort of start out when it was in the sort of great before of ideas, I suppose? What was the first nugget?
I'm one of these guys that found my passion when I was a kid. I was like 8 years old and I saw a flip book and my brain exploded, and I've been fascinated by animation ever since. But as I finished Inside Out, I realized, you know, I've been lucky enough to accomplish more in my professional career than I'd ever dreamed. And yet I didn't feel like I was all settled and worked out in my life. And I wondered if there was something more that I was meant to be doing. And so I set out to make a film that sort of reflected that journey of as an artist, you know, is living your dreams, the thing we're always taught throughout our lives, is that really the answer to life? So I know those are heady and big kind of concepts that maybe people wouldn't expect from animation. But, you know, I feel like there's no reason why animation can't be used to investigate these kind of ideas. So we dove in. The other thing that was sort of coupled with that, my kids were getting to an age where they were going to graduate from college and go out into the world and embark on their own lives. And I started reflecting on the fact that even as infants, I could kind of see who they were in there. You know, as they grew up, you look back and you go, oh yeah, they had that same sense of you know, strength or stubbornness or whatever it is. Where did that come from? You know, and my two kids are very different from each other. And yet they have the same parents, grew up in the same house. And so, well, there must be somewhere that we're all given our personality, and investigating that was what led to the film.
You have these two very different worlds in the film. There's the bustle of New York City, and there's also the kind of simple serenity in a way of The Great Before. So what was the bigger challenge to animate out of those two spaces? Well,
I think probably more difficult was the Great Before, even to figure out what it looks like, you know, because I think we're all fairly familiar with the idea of a soul, but none of us know what it looks like. And so doing research, talking to priests and rabbis and, you know, folks familiar with Hindu and Buddhist traditions, everybody kind of said, well, it's non-physical, it's gaseous, it's ethereal, and that wasn't very helpful. So we had to kind of make something up that hopefully alluded to that, but also was clearly not of this earth, something that nobody had seen before and that was not culturally specific. We didn't want to accidentally say, hey, everybody comes from Greece or something, you know. That was a big challenge.
And so how did the design of the sort of soul characters actually come together? Because, yeah, as you say, in some ways, there's something obviously extremely simple about them, but the texture in their edges, it kind of feels like unlike anything you've really seen in animation before.
That's great to hear you say that. That is something that is rewarding for audiences. I know for me, I love when I go to a movie and you're like, whoa, I've never seen someone approach this way. You know, you try to do something new that is going to surprise people. Mm. And yet you also need to make sure that you have enough familiarity so that it's not just foreign. So what we really tried to do was to, beyond the religious and traditional research, as I mentioned, we did want the souls to feel like a very simplified version of a person. And so anything extraneous, ears, hair, we took all that out and we just like made them really, really simple. So they're just kind of a head with eyes and a mouth because we knew we wanted to be able to see their expressions. And most of the time, they don't even have arms or legs. Those can appear if they need to, but they're just kind of this blob of gas that sort of vaguely looks like a, you know, a person.
There's some really fun sort of, I suppose you could call them cameos from sort of historical figures. Were there any that you kind of wanted to include but didn't make the cut?
Yeah, just to explain that, 22 is this character played by Tina Fey. One of our conceits in the film is that souls who have not yet been born are trained in by souls who have. So Mother Teresa might come forward as a deceased person and help train in new souls to make them ready for Earth. And 22 has been here so long. She has had the greats. She had like Copernicus, Mother Teresa, as I mentioned. We did try to get in Rasputin. And not that he's a great historical figure, but we just had some good jokes with him. It was interesting, too, because we wanted to balance out, again, because of our cultural bias, a lot of historical figures that we're aware of are middle-aged white guys, and we wanted to kind of balance out the world and genders, so that was tricky.
And kind of talking of the two worlds of the film as well, it also has these two very different soundtracks. So can you talk a bit about how each of those came together?
Yeah, that was really fun. We really tried to push things there as well. You know, traditionally, as if you've seen Pixar films, we do kind of lean towards the more traditional soundtracks where we have the orchestra, 110-piece orchestra. It's great fun. That's one of the great joys of working on the films is those days when you get to go record with an orchestra. In this film, though, I felt like it really needed something different. I wanted a different approach and a different audio trademark or stamp on it. And so I had worked with Ren Kleiss on Inside Out. He is the sound designer of that film. And he, of course, has worked at a lot of, I think, all of David Fincher's films and worked with Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. So I kind of used Ren as a bridge to say, hey, do you think, would those guys maybe be interested in doing something? Turns out they were. They were very interested. But it was a stretch for both of us, right? It was a very different way of working for us at Pixar. And I think they were being asked to do something a little out of the wheelhouse of most of the Fincher films. But it really produced some great results, and I'm really happy. In the human world, we wanted Joe, who's a jazz musician, to feel very and sound very authentically like he just walked out of a club in New York. So we were very fortunate to work with John Batiste, who's a working jazz musician as well as a band leader for Stephen Colbert, Late Night with Stephen Colbert. So he brought just this wonderful, rich truth and authenticity to the music, but also helped really inform and educate us about the life that we were trying to portray on the film of a working jazz musician.
And another thing I wanted to ask specifically for the British audience is how you came to cast Graham Norton in the film, because he's kind of like a household name over here. But, is he playing it around the world? It's not just for UK audiences.
Well, no, a lot of us here are big fans of his show as well. but it's a little bit maybe outside of where you'd normally go. It was our casting folks. We have an in-house casting group. What they do generally, what I've asked them to do, is to grab little bits of dialogue, of audio only. I don't want to see the picture. I don't want to even know who this is. I just want to hear the voice, and I put it next to a picture of the character that we've designed for the film, and we just listen. And in this case, Graham Norton just was immediately perfect. And it wasn't until after they revealed who it was that, and then we thought, well, that was great.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much for your time today, and congratulations again on the film.
Oh, thanks. Thank you, Matt.
So that's Matt and Pete chatting about Soul. Let's talk about the film then. Did you guys like it? It's this very existential, experimental, very jazzy film. Seems to have a lot of the same beats as from a Pixar film, but also very different. Did it work?
I've got to say, this was one of my most anticipated films of the year, and I did absolutely love this film. Like you say, it's quite different to previous Pixar films, because on the surface, it sounds a lot like Inside Out, I think, because it sounds like this kind of cute characters in this kind of interior world, and you know how it relates to the real world. But I thought it was really quite different to Inside Out, and it's really one of those films that I don't say this as a negative, but it just doesn't feel like a children's film at all to me.
Not really, at all, because no.
There's absolutely no concessions to this being a children's film. There's none of the sort of things shoved in just for merch, or like, you know, where you feel like things are just specifically engineered to get maximum merchandise sales. I mean, it's just the complete opposite of like, you know, a Cars sequel or something like that. It's just feels very unique and original. But all that said, I was just so invested in it. And it's one of those films that really has stayed with me a lot since watching. I watched it like a week ago, but I've just thought about it so much since seeing it. And it really feels like one that I'll revisit a lot over the years.
Jack's already done a spoiler. He loves it. Why did you love it, Jack?
Similar to Matt, like it's very different. I hadn't really thought about how kids might enjoy it. But I guess there's like a cat in it, so the kids might enjoy the cat and the fun colours. But they have a lot of fun with everything going on, like even the afterlife, like all the characters are very quirky. A lot of the animation is really, really cool. I enjoyed the kind of the liney figures that they use in the afterlife. I don't really know how to explain.
They look like Picasso sort of drawings, yeah. Don't they? All called Jerry.
One of them is called Terry.
One of them's called Terry. Pretty much everyone else is called Jerry.
So what did you think of the film, Jane?
I didn't love it.
Oh,
why not? Gutted.
For all the reasons you're saying, and this is probably what makes me a Philistine, I did watch it with a child that I begot and shoved in front of the telly to see what a child would make of it. And a lot of it went over his head. But equally, I sort of was like, what? I don't want to have to think this hard when I'm watching a Pixar film. I was wanting more of an Inside Out. I wanted a Bing Bong, and I didn't feel it had that Bing Bong moment. I didn't feel moved by it. I just thought it was very beautiful, very well done, well conceived, and very ambitious, but it didn't get me. It didn't pull my heartstrings at all. And so for me, it's not a win as a Pixar. I really like that they're trying something different, but I want a kiddie film, and I want that gut punch emotional beat to be there. And I didn't find it in this. And also, you know, I know you're saying they had some fun. It wasn't that fun. It was quite a lot of serious issues being discussed. And cat aside, also I have, you know, a niggle about the cat, because I can't say it without spoiling, but like something happens to the cat and it's then seen in another place, but then something else swaps in and out, and it's like, so where is that cat now? Do you know what I mean? There's just a body of a cat now. When you've watched this, everyone, this will make sense. So that is what consumed me for quite a bit of the final third, rather than actually being moved by the story, which probably isn't the greatest. But I can see why people will love it.
I mean, I didn't have that cat issue. And I think my main issue was that after the film, like it's very much a message about, you know, living your life to the fullest and that kind of thing.
Mm.
And I was like, I just want to go outside and explore the world and do all this. And obviously we're stuck inside. So that was my main issue.
It is about finding the beauty in the small things, Jack. So you can go and look at the sun shining through the trees, or you could enjoy splashing in a puddle. You don't have to go far to do that. Doesn't matter what tier you're in, you could do that outside your door.
Fair point.
I just thought, yeah, maybe I almost related too hard to it in some ways, you know.
Are you having an existential crisis, Matt?
Yeah, maybe, yeah. And I just really kind of connected with it. And I loved also just, you know, as we discussed in the interviews, but I love these two different worlds and the different soundtracks you get with both of them. So you've got kind of John Batiste doing the sort of jazz soundtrack when you're in New York and when Joe's doing all his playing. And then you've got Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross doing the Great Before sort of electronic. Like they're both so different, but I just love them both. And they just really felt that they fitted really well together. And I can't wait to actually watch it again soon, to be honest.
I don't really love jazz either, which we had this problem when we discussed that Damien Chazelle show, which was like, I don't get jazz. So that was a disconnect for me as well, when they were like, jazz is so amazing and it moves you to this astral plane. It moves me to a plane of annoyance. So yeah, sorry. But music is subjective, right? You know, not everybody likes the same stuff.
No.
I like Bing Bong's song. That's, you know, that's my level. Who's the one who make Bing Bong? Bing Bong. That's what I'm looking for.
How would you rank this and this year's other big musical movie, Eurovision?
It's better than that.
The
songs better than Prom.
Ah, fair enough. I thought I really, really loved the soundtrack in this, especially, you know, the jazz stuff was really cool. But I also like, you know, as Matt was saying, the more ethereal music when they go onto the other plane. The contrast of the two works strangely well. Like I wasn't expecting it to work and then it did. I think it really sets the two worlds apart as well, not on just a visual level, but an audio one as well. You know, we've kind of had it before with Coco. In many ways, it kind of shares similar through lines with a lot of the afterlife stuff. But this movie feels very different to that. And I think maybe it is because it's telling it from an adult perspective. You know, Joe's an adult who's gone through life and, you know, we kind of see the depressing highlights of his life. It's quite a tough watch at times with moments like that.
I preferred Coco and I preferred Onward. I think Onward had elements of that with Barley, the guy who apparently hasn't done anything with his life, but actually what he's done is bring up his brother and be a father figure to him. And so there's that warmth in that. This one wasn't as successful for me, but I think we can say that it's two against one and probably the world against me, because I think everybody will love this film. I just didn't. So that is Soul, which hits Disney Plus on Christmas Day. You can watch that in your COVID secure household after the turkey. Right, so from one man contemplating his existence to another with this.
Come in, Ether. This is Barbo Observatory. Are you receiving this? Is anyone out there?
This is Ether. Does any one copy? We're not receiving anything.
That puts our last contact with Mission Control out.
3 weeks.
Why is it so quiet?
That's Ether. It's a spaceship that we hoped would be our future. I have to warn them about the conditions on Earth.
That's The Midnight Sky, directed by and starring George Clooney. Tell us what this is about, Jack.
So the movie takes place in a post-apocalyptic world where George Clooney is seemingly the only person left after everyone else is evacuated. So he is kind of trying to stay alive on this station in the Antarctic. And then he discovers that there is a spaceship coming down from a mission in space. And they're obviously returning to this world where no one's there. And he wants to try and send them a message to turn them around. And then suddenly there's a young girl with George Clooney who he also has to look after. There's another station which him and the girl have to make their way to be able to send the message to the spaceship because their antenna's not as powerful or something like that.
I feel like you've got a great grasp on this, Jack. It clearly hasn't connected with you, has it?
Isn't that what happens?
No, basically? It is.
It's a weird plot because it's like two big things all happening at once. Like half the movie is George Clooney as like a man on his own and then with this young girl who's kind of left behind. And then the other half of the movie is Felicity Jones and Kyle Chandler up in space doing whatever. I mean, for me, they felt very different and almost didn't work quite together.
And you also, don't forget, you've also got a flashback of Clooney's Augustine. You know, he's a great scientist who has devoted his life to science and the, you know, where we could go in space, what other planets we could discover, to the detriment of his own private life. So you've got flashbacks there as well. It hops around a lot. It's asking you to follow a lot of narratives and invest in all of those narratives. Is that an ask too much, Matt?
Yeah, sadly, I didn't think either side was particularly kind of gripping. Like, it's one of those weird films where there was a lot to admire about it, not least Clooney's beard, which is
extremely full Letterman,
epic.
Isn't
like,
it?
Yeah, it's an incredible beard. Like, it's that weird thing where his performance was good. I thought there were some nice effects in it, but I just was never really particularly invested in either side of the story in ways that I found hard to put a finger on. Because obviously you got the sort of survival kind of story on the Clooney side of things. Because
on Earth.
He's on Earth. He's trekking across these sort of, you know, treacherous snowy conditions with this girl. And, you know, they come into various mishaps. There's a few sort of big set pieces, you know, along those lines. And then you've obviously got the spaceship. And like Jack was saying, that feels very disconnected. And without saying too much, I didn't really feel particularly satisfied with the way it all came together and didn't find the resolution particularly satisfying. You know, it's all kind of leading to a sort of linking point. And there's a few things that I would say are fairly easy to guess where they're going. But yeah, I just was never particularly gripped by it, to be honest.
And it feels a lot like, you know, Clooney's taken some tips from Gravity. There's certainly some segments in the film that feel very like Gravity. You know, beautifully done, great special effects. There's sort of elements of the grey.
Yeah.
You know, like wolves in the snow. There's even elements of Interstellar with, you know, sort of what does family mean to you and what does getting back to family mean to you and the personal sort of cost of spearheading the search for other in the world. So it feels like a lot of other things you've seen. And as you say, it's nicely directed, you know, this lovely score and just well done, but weirdly emotionless.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's weird because one of the storylines, it feels like it wraps quite, not early, but, you know, kind of about halfway through. Mm. And then everything after that feels like, oh, well, the main emotional pull for me is kind of over. And now we're doing all this other stuff. So David Oyelowo is in the movie and he's on the spaceship and he plays exactly the same role in The Cloverfield Paradox as well, which is also a Netflix movie in a spaceship. And so I was suddenly getting like memories of that movie, but also him and Felicity Jones's character are supposed to be like in a relationship. Mm. And there was no spark there for me.
There's zero chemistry. Yeah, zero
but you
chemistry.
Know what I was thinking about that? I was thinking that there's a sort of similar thing when a certain tragedy happens and people are very stoic and that is what astronauts would be like. They have trained and trained and trained for awfulness and they just are super calm people who just get on with it. And so I thought that was in service to sort of the truth of what they'd be like. They wouldn't be like, oh my God, so-and-so is bleeding, or oh my God, I love you in space. They would be like that. But actually that's what makes it feel quite cold.
But I would also perhaps counter that comment by saying there's a couple of astronaut characters who go against that rationality you might expect from a sort of science-driven astronaut figure. And again, in ways that I didn't really quite buy. And there's like sort of good actors like Kyle Chandler, for example. You just can't kind of invest in their story as well, you know, like, because there's kind of, you know, bits of them sort of missing family back home and that kind of thing. You know, it's hard to really get sort of truly invested in that, I found, just because there's just too much else going on.
It did try to do so much with all these characters. I don't know, I was expecting it to go Alien and just, you know, killing them off one by one, which would have been quite fun, but it never quite went there.
Nothing about this film as well, especially watching it at the end of 2020. For a film that is kind of big and handsome and kind of, you know, epic, it's very downbeat. And,
bleak.
It launched on Netflix on the 23rd of December. Is this really just before Christmas what you really want to be seeing? Like, the Earth's been abandoned and, you know,
no families can be together.
Yeah, families can't be together. You know, well, I suppose we haven't even touched on the fact that Augustine's got this terminal illness, which is why he's stayed behind on the base. So things aren't exactly kind of, you know, looking too rosy for him from the very beginning. It's not exactly a feel-good film in the way that some films that aspire to the stars are. And that's not a bad thing, but because there wasn't that emotional connection as well, you didn't even really get that out of it. It wasn't like it was harrowingly beautiful. It was just a bit like,
They're all done for. Okay. So I think we're saying that, you know, if you enjoy, you know, a handsome, well-made, starry sci-fi, but you're not put off by a bit of bleak, this one's for you on the 23rd on Netflix. All right, enough of a male leads then. Shall we make time for this woman?
Nothing good is born from lies. And greatness is not what you think.
So that's Wonder Woman 1984. Where do we find Wonders? Obviously, she's in 1984, but what's she up to?
Okay, so we do get a brief flashback to her childhood in Themyscira, which is very welcome. That's like we get like a really great rousing opening scene there of her learning an important life lesson as a kid, taking part in these sort of Amazonian Olympic Games type thing. And yeah, it's a really great rousing sort of set piece to start off on. But then we find her obviously in 1984, she's working at the Smithsonian, dealing with, you know, like...
Antiquities,
basically. Still mourning the loss of Steve Trevor. And basically into her story comes Barbara Ann Minerva, played by Kristen Wiig, who is an archaeologist who also starts working there and kind of befriends her and really looks up to her and how, you know, I mean, who wouldn't because of like how cool and sort of graceful and everything she is.
Yes.
But obviously kind of slightly nerdy Barbara obviously just kind of really sort of falls for her. And then also into the mix comes Max Lord, played by Pedro Pascal. And he's this kind of businessman who has this kind of scheme to get people rich off oil. You can sense there's something a bit dodgy about him. He epitomizes that 80s greed and excess. And they all kind of converge early on when this mysterious kind of fake looking rock appears at the Smithsonian for Barbara to take a look at. She thinks it's a little fake, you know, but Max sees that it might be something more valuable and wants to get his hands on it. So that's where things kick off.
And that is the nucleus for a lot of things changing for everybody. Some things are good, some things not so good. Obviously, we see the return of Chris Pine as Steve Trevor. We can't say how, but it's very welcome. Did you enjoy, obviously, the juxtaposition of the sort of comedy of the fish out of water of Steve Trevor in 1984 and enjoying bum bags for the first time? And also this larger story, which is sort of about what happens if you get what you want.
I really loved Chris Pine and Gal Gadot in this. They're so excellent together and the chemistry is off the wall. It's so good. But I found the plot itself very messy. I thought that the MacGuffin in it was very strange. I was asking myself a lot of questions about how it works the whole time and why certain things weren't happening.
You wanted to know the rules. You wanted the rules set out for this particular item.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I really liked Pedro in this as the villain. I thought he was, Patty Jenkins does a really good job of kind of giving equal time to kind of Kristen Wiig and Pedro and then Gal and Chris together. You know, it kind of feels like there are three ongoing storylines. They're all intertwining, but all given quite equal pacing as well. But that also, when it's tied together by something that I don't really understand and also feels somehow slightly at odds with the gravity of everything, it made it feel slightly off kilter to me.
We'll discuss that aspect more, I think, when we have our spoiler chat coming soon. But to keep things spoiler free, I just really, really, really enjoyed this film. And I know everyone's saying this, but it does just feel like that kind of tonic for right now when you know, you obviously know from the first film that just inherent goodness of Wonder Woman and Diana Prince. And obviously how Gal sort of, you know, exudes that as well in her performance. And I just thought it was just like really a lot of fun. It like feels like an 80s throwback movie in a lot of ways. And at the start, it feels very Richard Donner's Superman to me because I love this kind of sequence really early on where you just basically see she's just out and about doing some superhero stuff and sort of saving people.
At the mall.
And to me, that's something you never get enough of in superhero films is just them doing the sort of everyday superhero saving. I love that stuff. And yeah, there's just something like, even though, you know, it obviously gets big, you know, but I just felt it was just fun and good-hearted. And I just found it just a really sort of enjoyable blockbuster that I feel like, you know, one of those ones you could sort of sit down with the whole family and watch. It had that kind of 80s feel in that way, you know, where it was just rousing entertainment. That's what I would say.
It is rousing entertainment. It does have some great set pieces. I mean, it has this particular, we've seen in the trailer, so it's not a spoiler, where, you know, she's trying to stop a whole cavalcade of armored vehicles in the desert. And there's nods in that to Indiana Jones. I mean, it's
you
can't avoid that similarity. That sort of seems to be the level at which it is. I mean, that if you were to pick apart Indiana Jones, there's magic and myth that doesn't really make sense. And there are rules that aren't particularly clear on certain objects. But it's the romp of it, isn't it? And for me, this is a total romp. But also, as you say, Gal Gadot doing just literally glows. I don't know how she exudes such goodness, kindness, respect for people, but also she manages to tinge that with the sadness and the grief over Steve Trevor. She brought a tear to my eye. I just think she's absolutely wonderful. And whenever she's on screen, I want to watch it. My problem with it was the ropey-esque CGI. Won't say where that comes in, but it kind of lets it down a little bit. It's a bit long-winded in some segments that could be speeded up, I think. It's a tiny bit long. But if you want to see Wonder Woman doing her thing, this is just, you know, an absolute treat.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm slightly more ambivalent towards it because, like, in the first Wonder Woman, I found the last third not very good. It kind of exploded in this CGI battle and it just didn't work for me. And I found similar here. Like, I just didn't find that it wrapped everything up in a satisfying way. And also, I felt slightly lectured to at the end as well. I think I'm in the minority there. I do think you're right about Gal. I mean, it's been long enough since she covered Imagine for me to forget about that and just see wonders. So
put that out of your mind.
Yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of the more kind of like seeing superheroes do superhero stuff and not having to kind of overdo the action as well. You know, we've become so reliant on seeing everyone punching everyone else all the time in, you know, the Avengers movies and stuff. And this is very much a different kind of superhero movie. It's very like feel good. And you know, we'll spend 5 minutes seeing Chris doing like, you know, makeovers and stuff.
I love
trying
that.
Out different outfits. Yeah.
Who doesn't love when somebody in an 80s movie goes for a makeover? It's like it should have had Pretty Woman playing in the background, right? He's wearing all different outfits, different zips, different bum bags. I loved it.
Yeah, when it got bogged down, it was in the kind of the grandiose of the story and, you know, this object. And then, you know, there's a line when, and it's in the trailer, when Kristen Wiig goes like, I want to be an apex predator. And it's like, oh no. I think that's the moment in the movie where it stopped working for me.
You didn't want her to become Cheetah. You liked her as Barbara.
It felt entirely unnecessary. But I don't want to go into specifics. You know, I still think it's
like an enjoyable
movie.
We'll go into specifics in the spoiler chat, won't we?
Yeah.
I mean, I still very much enjoyed it. And I really liked the setting and seeing, you know, Chris is the fish out of water and the reverse from the first movie is a lot of fun.
I don't think you can underestimate how important it is to see a film like this as a girl. And I think what a film for little girls to watch, you know, that is about being kind, being proud of who you are, being strong, all of the things that we want to teach generations coming up, that, you know, all of these great values. I think it's an amazing film to have in the world for women and girls.
But not you, Jack. You're an asshole, Jack.
Not you, Jack. Not you. Because you just don't appreciate the wonder of wonders.
It's not a film made for me particularly, but I can still enjoy it. And I can completely see that, you know, for other people, it will mean a lot more. Like the first Wonder Woman means so much to so many people. So, yeah, I mean, good on it for that.
Well, we gave it 4 stars in the magazine. Would you say less, Jack?
I would probably go for 3. You know, there's still a lot to enjoy there. There are some, you know, moments that I feel are let down. And I don't think like 4's like an outrageous score. I can understand why someone would give it 5 if you really bought into the character and the kind of feel goodness of lots of it. And that is a movie that I think on Christmas Day, when, you know, all the Americans are streaming it and we're all sitting here going, I wish I could stream that.
I know. What a mistake. Why have they not made it possible for us?
I think, you know, it's going to be a great movie for like families to sit down and watch.
Those of us that are lucky enough not to be in a tier where the cinemas are closed can go and see it now. So Godspeed to everyone going to see that. It's a cracker. Okay, so shall we move on to another film that's out this week? It's time for Kevin Costner with this.
We're trying to locate a Donnie Wee Boy. He married our son's widow. Got our grandson with him.
You let it be known you're looking for a Wee Boy. I'll find you.
We thought we'd see Jimmy, since we're in the neighborhood.
Since you're in the neighborhood?
Go careful.
This is Let Him Go, starring Superman's parents, Kevin Costner and Diane Lane. What are they up to, Matt?
Yep, Ma and Pa Kent in this. And we're in 60s Montana, and George and Margaret Blackledge are the characters they play. Kevin plays a retired sheriff and Diane Lane's his wife. And basically, early on, we see they get visited by a tragedy when their kind of grown-up son dies, leaving a sort of a widow and a son. And then the widow ends up remarrying, and someone who sort of this slightly unsavory seeming type, we get the impression early on he's perhaps not the nicest guy. And then before we know it, they've been kind of whisked off to this guy's home, and they're missing their sort of beloved little grandson. And this sets them off on a mission, basically, to find where they're living now, based on what's happened to them. They discover that this guy, Donnie, is a member of this family called the Wee Boys.
The Wee Boys.
Presided over by a very tough matriarch played by Leslie Manville. And that's where it goes from there, really.
Doesn't it?
It gets dark. And it's very, very slow burn, very much in the kind of Western tradition, sort of really, really slow burn. More so than I was expecting, maybe, if you've seen kind of trailers and posters. You know, it's not an action film by any means. It's not that kind of Western. But that's the story basics for you.
I loved it. I mean, I have to declare that I love the Costner. So pretty much anything he does, I will watch. I just thought this was beautifully done. Did you like it?
It's hard to go wrong with Costner in a wide-brimmed hat, isn't it, really? But I actually, this one's for me, where there was a lot of it that I thought, come on, this is very melodramatic and predictable. But I just weirdly just enjoyed it all the same. There was just something about it, yeah, that again just sort of pulled me in. The gravitas of the sort of, especially the three main players, the old-fashionedness of it, the sort of stripped back of it, and just, you know, that it is really just a very simple story. And I found something oddly, maybe as well, this is a thing that I'd perhaps warn, like, people like my parents, for example, who are kind of grandparents unable to see their grandchildren at the moment.
It's upsetting.
It kind of it sort of hits a bit harder than perhaps it would have done at other times, because that kind of thing almost got to me quite a bit, and I really sort of did feel for them and, you know, this kid. I liked it. What about you, Jack?
I found it very watchable. It was perhaps slightly predictable, and, you know, all the action was fine, and I quite liked the performances. When I started it, I wasn't in the right mindset, because I'd just put up my Christmas tree, and then suddenly we're going into this like dark movie where like a character just dies in like a freak horse accident straight away, and it's just like, whoa, this is quite heavy. I also couldn't stop laughing at the name Wee Boy. I don't know, it made me think
of like,
it made me think of some like weird internet culture thing, like e-boy or something, where it's just like the Wee Boys are coming.
It kept making me think of Jackass. That was Wee Man, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Come on, there is hope in this film. There's, you know, there's the lovely relationship between the two main characters and their marriage that has lasted through tragedy and all the years that they've been married, and they're the sort of absolute complete opposite to the Wee Boys, who feel like something out of, you know, a Western, this family of horrors. And, you know, let's talk about Leslie Manville's performance. Has anyone offered a pork chop more threateningly than this woman? I mean, there's a wonderful scene in this when they go to the house to have dinner, ostensibly, and it's essentially a dick swinging contest, isn't it? And it's just cracking. You could imagine this on a stage. It crackles with tension. Everything that is said has another meaning, and the threat of violence is just heavy in the air. And from there on, the violence becomes not suggested but real. And what do you do in that situation? And I just thought it was very, very compelling and brilliant performances. And I loved seeing, you know, the leader of this horrible family was Leslie Manville's peroxide coiffed mama, who wears a headscarf to go and visit people and unleash hell upon them. I just thought it was really, really great.
She was very menacing.
Very menacing. You know, and also, you know, like, I love Costner, I have to admit it, but he just brings that Gal Gadot effect. When Costner plays a role like this, you absolutely believe in his goodness, his fact that he can't be turned, that he's righteous, he runs by the law, and he's going to do the right thing. So the battle between the light and the dark in this was really interesting to see which would win.
I think, because at the beginning, it seems like he doesn't really want to go on this trip. I know it's like he does want to go, but then he kind of doesn't want to go. I don't know. It made the character a bit more complicated than that for me. And I think it didn't work that well for me.
But didn't you just think that he was like, he's like this taciturn former sheriff who's now this horse farmer. He doesn't show his emotions. And when it matters, he goes out to bat. His reluctance at the beginning is paid off by what happens in the final third of the film. It's earned and it feels earned.
I thought it made an interesting dynamic between the two of them as well, Costner and Lane, in the way that obviously her character is just, she is the real driving force. She's the one who's sort of desperate to get the kid back. And he is a bit more sort of, come on, we're a bit old to take him on ourselves. You know, he is a bit unsure. And I kind of liked that dynamic to it all, that you didn't just have them both just raring in there from the get-go. And it was kind of also, it felt to me a lot about what he would do for her as well, was almost that was how I read quite a lot of it as well, that it was kind of maybe that he grew to realise just how important it was for her basically to have that going forward, you know.
Yeah, but so there's also a lot about women's intuition in this, and, you know, that he doesn't see what she sees in that marriage. So he doesn't feel there's this impetus to make sure that the child is safe. And I just love that. And I love the fact that there's also this understanding between their son's widow and Diane Lane's character as well, that there are ways that women need to work together, especially in 1960s rural America at this time, in order to ensure that everybody's safe. And, you know, there's this idea that women are, you know, at risk from domestic violence or from just not having a say in where they live or work. I like that as well. It's not just a sort of guy's movie about posturing with guns in, you know, against the badlands of Dakota, which look beautiful. It is about family and life and all of the things that all audiences could understand.
I thought it was like, felt slightly cliched in places, you know. And I would say Costner's character was at the center of that, you know, the kind of like former sheriff who's going to like, you know, do good in the end and save the day or whatever. And I really enjoyed Diane Lane and Leslie Manville in it a lot more than him. He was slightly the weak link as this kind of stoic, masculine bloke. It made an interesting dynamic, him being reluctant, but at the same time, it just made me very annoyed with him.
But he's always being driven by Diane Lane's character. She says she's going, so he needs to follow. Even at one point when there's this sort of hairy point where they're following a car, he's following to catch up to her. She's driving everything. I feel like it was about strong women and not necessarily about this taciturn man.
I also think there's no hope for Jack if he's immune to that Costner charisma.
Come
as
on.
Well. Like, Jack, come on, just
when he puts
turn
on
it off
a cowboy hat,
just,
it doesn't do it for you. Seriously. Or when he rides off on a horse, like at great speed. We've seen
Diane Lane on a
horse. Come on, these two.
She's great on a horse. Yeah.
There you go. That's the poster quote for this one. Diane Lane, he's great on a horse. If you enjoy Diane Lane on a horse, or Kevin Costner on a horse for that matter, you can see this film in cinemas, tears permitting, from this Friday. So do check it out. I loved it. They're not so hot on it, but it's a good one. And it's a different film to watch if you're not into your Wonder Woman. Okay, so that's it for this week. There's not a great deal for us to talk about more, except for Shall We Answer a Reader's Question? This is one we often talk about, I think, in the office, when we're in the office together. What movie will you always watch if you catch it on TV, no matter how many times you've seen it or where it is in the film? Jack?
Probably Jurassic Park.
Good one.
I feel like it's always on ITV, and every time it's on, you kind of put it on and just end up watching it all the way through. It's so easy just to drop in at any moment and there's something iconic or something that's about to be thrilling, or, you know, a dinosaur's going to run on screen. And the CGI, you know, it hasn't aged that poorly at all. It still looks really good. And I just love the central characters in it. I adore that movie. And it's funny that they always show the sequels on ITV because I don't have much time for them. But the original, banging, we'd watch that.
Yeah, that's a good shout. I'll be honest, I'd have trouble turning any of the three of them off. But off the top of my head, when this question was asked, Casino Royale is the film that comes up for me. Another mainstay of like the ITV2 schedule. And it's just one of those things that wherever you are in it, again, especially because there's just so many like great set pieces in that film. If that's on and I just catch a bit of out the corner of my eye, I just can't stop thinking, oh, I just sit here for like 5 minutes and just watch a bit more. And then before you know it, you've watched the whole thing.
I feel like that's true of most Bond films. You turn it on and Roger Moore in Moonraker. I'm going to sit through that, definitely. The one that I always would watch if it's on, you know, even in the ad breaks and I'd endure, is Bridesmaids, because I've seen it so many times. I still laugh at it. I still enjoy Kristen Wiig busting up a chocolate fountain. I just think Melissa McCarthy's great in it. And I think it's just really funny and really good. John Hamm, everyone's great in it. So that any point that I enter that film, I'm enjoying that moment because I'm like, oh, this is the bit, you know, with the drive-bys trying to get the officer's attention. Oh, this is the bit with the party gone terribly wrong. This is the wedding dress trying on scene. I'm definitely watching this with the vomiting in the bathroom. I'm always going to watch that. Love it. Speaking of wonderful things you can look at, our new issue's out as well. We should mention that. You can dip in and out of that like you can a Bond film. What's going on in this issue, Matt?
For the most part, it's like an epic review of the year. Like, obviously, 2020 has been like a crazy year for us all, but there have been some amazing films out and lots of cool people doing cool stuff. So, yeah, we just basically look back on all that with some sort of famous contributors to help us along the way.
Contributors, yes, we did. And, we had some directors and actors help us out with trying to make sense of 2020. And we had Borat saying he might be Bond. So if you're interested in what Sacha Baron Cohen thinks of being the new comedy Bond, do pick it up. It's in all good stores now, and that's not affected by tears, so buy it. Okay, that is all we have time for this week. We will be back next week. And for now, we'll just say goodbye. Say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.